Hello, friends. This is the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. The goal of the AlphaList podcast is to empower CTOs with the info and insight they need to make the best decisions for their company. We do this by hosting top thought leaders and picking their brains for insights into technical leadership and tech trends. If you believe in the power of accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. Plus, if you're an experienced CTO, you will love the discussion happening in our Slack space where over 600 CTOs are sharing insights, or visit one of our events. Just go to alphaList.com to apply. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby, and today I have a very special guest. It's Scott Chacon, one of the founders of GitHub. He sold GitHub for, I think, like $7.5 billion, $8 billion to Microsoft, and then moved to Berlin, like after that, I think, founded two companies, Chatterbug, and now he's doing the same thing again and founded GitButler. Recently, doing lots of public speeches. I see you everywhere, I have to admit.
Yeah.
And really happy to have you here, Scott.
Yeah, welcome. I'm happy to be on. Thank you.
So maybe we start early. Like, how and why did you get into computing? Like, what's your personal nerd journey?
That's a good, I think, like a lot of people my age, I started with the TI-82 calculator. So I remember programming it I took computer programming classes, I think, in high school. I didn't really get into it before that too much. My grandpa had some computers where, you know, like the big floppy disk that you'd put in and then had like a handle that you'd pull down and stuff. So I'm from that era, but it really started with the stupid calculator that we had in high school, and you could program it to do all sorts of stuff. And I remember programming it because I would put some game, I would made like Monopoly on it and some, you know, a Lemmings game or something. And I found it just really fun to be able to make it do stuff it wasn't really designed to do. And I made a program where as the teacher would go through and try to clear the memory of them so you wouldn't write like notes for, you know, the tests or whatever. And so I wrote a program where you could hit the button sequence that would clear the calculator memory, except it was a program that pretended to clear the calculator memory because I didn't want to lose the programs I was doing. But it wasn't to cheat. It was just so that I wouldn't lose, you know, Lemmings or whatever it was I was working on. So that was kind of the beginning of really finding it fun to hack and tinker on stuff.
And next step, like, why did you make it your profession?
Well, actually, I graduated from school. I went to UCSD and I graduated and I wanted to become a linguist. So I was going to get a master's degree in linguistics. And before that happened, I was kind of very broke and I got a job doing computer programming. I had been doing programming my whole time through college. That's kind of how I worked my way through college. And I just decided it was much easier. I enjoyed doing it and it paid much, much better. So I ended up just kind of going down that route, which obviously I have not regretted, but you know, comes back into Chatterbug later I've always had this sort of fascination with languages and linguistics. And so that was kind of how it started.
Okay, cool. And what is the story behind GitHub?
So GitHub, actually, so I worked in tech in the Bay Area for several years after I graduated from college, and I got into Ruby. I was in PHP, like, a you know, sort of a lot of people doing websites at the time, and I really liked it, and I had worked in PHP for years. And then Rails came out, and I had read a lot of the same books, I think, that had inspired sort of the framework for Rails, and I was trying to do similar stuff in PHP and kind of writing my own frameworks and that were similar to that, sort of controller model view stuff. And it came out, and I was like, this is super cool, and I started writing some websites in it, and then I started going to these Ruby meetups because of that, and I met the GitHub guys at Ruby meetups. And at the time, I was really into Git because we were using Git at the company I was at, and I kind of became known, I think, in these Ruby meetups as the Git guy. I was kind of sort of obsessed with Git, and I was rewriting Git in, you know, Ruby and sort of like internals and stuff. an action script. And like, I would always kind of go to these Ruby meetups and show some dumb stuff I was working on in Git. I met Tom and Chris and PJ and they sort of contracted me to work on Gist. So one of my small claims to fame is I have Gist number one. So if you go to gist.github.com/schicone/1, that's the very first Gist, and it's mine. But that was kind of how I met them and started working with them on GitHub stuff, and then it was kind of a side project for everybody at that time, and then we incorporated GitHub, and you know, the rest is history. But that's how I met everybody.
And you kind of, you didn't walk down the VC lane at the beginning, right? You rather bootstrapped it, or?
Yeah, no, I think Chris actually put in a little bit of seed money, and we kind of bootstrapped it from there. It started making money relatively quickly. I think we put it out as just sort of, you know, Chris and Tom put it out as this sort of much nicer Git hosting solution, you know, that didn't suck as much as like repo.or.cz or whatever kind of existed before that. And people started saying, hey, can we, you know, pay for private repositories? And we were like, yeah, I think PJ went and wrote the first billing system over the weekend so that we could start taking money from people. It was like, if you want to give us your money, that's fantastic. Let's do that. So, and it grew enough where we could kind of quit our jobs, and we all quit our jobs around the same time. And I think I took I think I was making a quarter of what I was making at the job that I quit in order to do this when we first started GitHub. And I was like, I'm going to go broke, but this is way more fun than doing what I was doing before. So that was kind of the beginning. I mean, before that, we were just kind of using it for beer money, like meeting on Fridays and, you know, at this Irish pub in North Beach and using the proceeds of GitHub to buy beer and talk about what we wanted to do next. And then it exploded over time. It was a very slow explosion. I don't think we got enough money to hire another developer for another year, probably after we quit our jobs.
But it was also not really needed, right? Like because you were like a small, efficient team, and the topic kind of worked out, or.
Yeah, I mean, we also lucked out in that we knew a lot of people in the area, right? Like the Ruby meetup was full of people from EngineYard and Twitter and you know, all of these companies. And we kind of cut a deal. I can't remember if it was Chris or Tom cut a deal with EngineYard where we had free hosting so that if we put their logo on the bottom of our website. And they really bankrolled sort of the server costs for a long time in a way that allowed us to bootstrap in a way that I think would have been difficult otherwise. But yeah, over time we it just grew organically for a long time, and then we didn't need VC money. I think we were approached by VCs a lot of times. I remember very specifically us talking about this in the early days. Should we take this money and try to accelerate growth? And it just never really seemed worth it. And the VCs that we talked to, I remember this to this day because, you know, now I do some angel investing and stuff, is somebody told us that the total market cap of the entire industry that we were in was like $100 million, right? And so like – and then you know, I mean, you fast forward 8 years and you know, the company sells for $7 billion – like just our company sells for $7 billion, right? And then there's also GitLab, which is essentially the same, you know, sort of a copy of the same – type of thing, which is an IPO'd company. So like, obviously the market cap is very big. And so I kind of took from that, never really take, you know, VC's opinions too seriously, because they also don't know what they're talking about. Nobody really knows what they're talking about.
But then you also took some money before you sold, I guess, right? Or was it all yours?
We did.
Like when you sold?
Yeah, no. I mean, we bootstrapped I think the company was 150 employees probably bootstrapped. And we at some point we started talking to VC. I mean, everybody really wanted to, we had no investment. And so every VC company wanted to invest in us because all their portfolio companies used GitHub. And they knew that we had not had any investment. And so we did sort of this round where we had VCs pitch to us why we should take their money. So we kind of did made everybody do a reverse pitch, like come to our office and tell us why we should take their money. And it was kind of a really arrogant, ridiculous process. And I'm a little embarrassed about parts of it now, but it was, you know, fun, and we were young and we were in the position to be able to do that almost nobody else is ever in. But in the end, we took it because we liked what we were doing, and we felt that we were really changing the landscape of software development, and we kind of, I think in the end, we argued about it a lot, right? And in the end, we kind of figured go big or go home. And you know, because we knew it needed, if you take money, like you have to have an exit at some point, right? And so we kind of set this timeline when we did that. And we argued if we wanted to set that timeline or if we wanted to more, you know, just control our own company and our own destiny. And it was not the easiest decision in the world to make. And we did do it. And I think it worked out well for everybody. The company, the, you know, open source, the people using GitHub, Microsoft in the end, I think has benefited from this as well. Obviously all of our investors did very well, personally, but it wasn't a clear decision. Like it wasn't clear at the time that that was the right decision to make.
And then you sold and moved to Berlin straight away or like, why did you move at all?
No, I left GitHub before we sold the company, a couple of years before we sold the company. It had gotten very big. Two of the co-founders had already left. It was a 450 person company, I think, by the time that I left. And I wanted to do startups again. And so I left and I started a company called Chatterbug, which was a language learning company. And it's still running, but I've moved on to GitButler since then. But when I left, we had started this language learning company, and so most of the people we hired ended up being in Berlin because we could find good teachers. There's, you know, it was this diverse sort of area. Europe was a much better market for language learning services and that we were trying to do. And so I ended up moving to Berlin after I was traveling back and forth all the time and eventually moved to Berlin. And now I'm married to a wonderful German woman and we have a kid and stuff. So now I'm a Berliner, I think, for good at this point. But yeah, that was kind of the journey. It was step by step. And then, yeah, GitHub sold somewhere in the middle of that.
Okay, cool. And now you're back to version control.
Yeah.
Why?
I can't get away from it. I was in language learning for a while, and it's a very, very difficult market, and it was very interesting to me. As I said, like I have a long time fascination with linguistics and learning languages and stuff, and I'm horrible at learning languages, and so I always liked teaching. Like even at GitHub, that was a lot of my role. Right, was teaching people about Git, writing pro Git. Evangelizing Git, trying to make a difficult system easy in a way that made people's lives better, and so that's always been fascinating to me. I don't think I'm a very smart person, and so if I can figure something out, then I feel like it's on me to try to help other people figure it out a little bit easier and take advantage of what comes from that. So I got into language learning for that, but in the end I love developer tools. Like I love writing software. I tried to take some time off. Chatterbug kind of wound down after working on it for 6 or 7 years. And I tried to take some time off, and I think not working is not for me. It's just very difficult to not hack on something or not have some project or something that could be big and it's just so interesting and fascinating. And so I looked at the landscape. I had done some angel investing, and one of the companies was on this new version control system, and it didn't quite work out. But I thought that the idea was so interesting around it, and so I approached him and said, you know, I kind of want to try this again. And then Kirill, he had a company that was called Sturdy and then turned into AI PR review company called Codeball. And I was like, I want to go back to the version control thing. Do you mind if I take this, you know, and kind of run with it? And he was like, actually, let me join you. So he and Ann and I co-founded GitButler to try to go back to version control because it's so interesting. Like, I feel like looking at problem sets from first principles, like I think we've all kind of been blinded by the success and ubiquity of GitHub, right? Like it's everybody's software development process now, and I think it's somewhat rare to look at all the things that Git and GitHub do and try to rethink them a little bit, right? Like what we have modern software development processes. Git hasn't changed in 15 years, right? Like what could we be doing? What could a version control if GitHub had written the client, what might it have looked like, right? Like if it was sort of redesigned from first principles. And I became kind of obsessed with this idea of let's tear everything down. And if we built it from scratch, to meet the software development needs that we have today, would it be Git or you know, would it be something different, right? And I like that it's always fun to go back to first principles and think about things and be like, what would a better system be? And I think Git is ripe for that because it hasn't changed in a long time. It was written for a very different development workflow, right? It was written for Linux kernel developers and mailing list developers, and a lot of the tools are still kind of designed around that philosophy. And GitHub, I think, made the best of it, but it's not really, if you started from scratch of like, how do we really want to work? I don't think that's exactly the system that we would design today.
And what do you think can be done better?
Well, there's lots of things.
I mean, peer reviews or?
I think peer reviews is one. You know, pull requests are great and everybody uses them, but there's a lot of, you know, like right now I'm trying to work on something that is more like a Jupyter notebook for code, right? Where you can kind of put in text in between code examples and annotate code and things like that, rather than kind of having your pull request description and comments in one tab and then sort of alphabetized list of code changes as a unified diff in another. Like I think being able to integrate them and update them and have a living document that says, here's what this branch looks like. I think that's much more interesting as a review process, right? And much, much easier on the reviewer, or could be. But there's lots of stuff. I mean, if you think about almost anything in Git, like take commits are an interesting example, right? Like commits are massively overloaded. Like you use the Git commit command to do lots of very different things, right? Like you use it to save your work. So you have these like kind of crappy work in progress commits, right? Because if you don't commit, then Git just doesn't remember. Like it's not recording anything. It's not like Google Docs where it's just recording everything and saving your progress as you go. It never remembers anything. And if you run the wrong command, you can lose stuff, right? And so you do these little commits or to switch branches, you have to commit, right? Just to save the work really, or stash, which is basically a commit that doesn't go into a branch. But like you have to do that. You also have to use it to transfer data, right? So you have to commit in order to push code to GitHub, for example, to get somebody to look at it. Like nobody can look at your code unless you commit it. And then you use commit to document your changes as well, right? And so, and this is why people do sort of PRs and then squash merges is because, and they just don't care about the commits, or they say every pull request should be like one good commit, right? And they should be very small and we should do stack diffs and things like that, is because we don't know how to. We're trying to use these tools that were written for kernel developers in a modern workflow that doesn't really work for how we want to work for the most part. And so what I really want to do is kind of look at that and break that apart and say, so like GitButler, for example, just records your working directory. Every change you make, it just does a CRDT of every file so that it's always like it can recreate any minute of what your history is at any point. You never lose anything, right? You never have to do work in progress commits. And it can transfer data but without committing, and you can review code and see changes of other people without ever having to do commits. You can just kind of synchronize the file system all the time and sort of that recorded history, and then you can commit whenever you want to, right? And say, okay, now I'm ready. Now I actually want to commit to my changes, right? And then you write out the changes. Here's the changes that I made, right? And actually write good commit messages that can be inspected later in a way that makes sense. Like right now, if you send out something for review and push it to a PR, and then somebody gives you review, you either have to, and you know, like you can't incorporate those changes into the commits that they were supposed to modify. You have to do another commit that you push to the end and say, okay, I'm fixing some review comments, right? But like then if you blame, then you get a commit message that says, hey, fixing some review comments, but not actually the change that was introduced, right? It would be better to re-roll the series like you can in a mailing list context, which again is kind of how the tool was designed, but GitHub PRs make that very difficult to do. You can do it, but A, it's hard, and B, then you have to force push the branch. And so if you're working on the branch with somebody, then that becomes problematic as well, right? And so I feel like there's better ways of approaching all of these problems. And it's just more about a sense of you know, imagination. Like what should this process look like? And how could we design tools to do it properly?
Mm. And but it sounds all like enhancing the Git protocol and really changing the inner core, and not like just writing a client. What are your thoughts on that?
I feel like the Git protocol is fine, right? Like it's in the end of the day, it's a list of snapshots, right? And so I think we can have a lot of imagination on the how do we create this list of snapshots and how do we manage this list of snapshots. I don't think the data structure is bad. I think it's actually a really versatile, you know, kind of key value store, DAG. Like it's a very good versatile structure. It's great at transferring data. It's great at just transferring the differences between what the server has and what you have. Like, I think all of that is, it's a fantastic file transfer protocol. And I don't think that there's that much that we can get into this later about like sort of sparse, you know, checkouts and things like that. Like there are things around that or resumable pushes or things like there are parts of the protocol that I think can be enhanced. But at the end, it's a very good, solid core protocol, right? Like you don't need a better sort of, I don't know. I kind of think about it the way that I think about databases. Like, you know, you can have a solid database like Postgres or MySQL or something, and then you can write tools on top of it that the tools progressively enhance much faster, right? You get better ORMs, you get better BI tools, you get better things that manipulate this core data structure. But I think the core data structure is actually very good, right? Like the way that we write tables and relational tables and SQL and things like that, I think all of that hasn't changed very much for a long time and it's very solid. The tools that we use to manipulate that and to create that data and to report on that data, that those can be massively enhanced without having to mess with Postgres, right? And I think that version control is the same. I think Git is a fantastic core data structure and transfer mechanism, but there are tools, the tools to write that data and to report on that data, Git log or, you know, sort of branch differences or whatever, none of that has really been changed that fundamentally in a decade at least, right? And I think the last big sort of mind change around at least the reporting part of that is GitHub, is you know, pull requests and stuff. But like the client itself is essentially the same that it was 15 years ago. So I think there are a lot of ways of looking at that and saying, how can we make this process of creating trees better, right? And that aren't necessarily how Git operates exactly today.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think like pull requests never became part of Git really? Like why is it a layer on top?
Well, I mean, they were, right? I mean, it comes from the request pull command, which is comes from, I have my own Git server. They really thought about it. It was going to be this more distributed system, right? Everybody will have their own tree. Linus will have his tree and, you know, the lieutenant will have his tree or whatever. And you send an email that says, okay, I've pushed my changes to my tree, pull from my tree, right? And then merge it into yours. And you do that locally. And we kind of took that same model and just tried to make it easier by not making it so you had to have it locally necessarily. You could have a merge button. You could see the diff on a website that everybody could see and comment on rather than having to pull it locally and do that difference yourself and look at it and comment on it or comment on a mailing list or something. And so I think fundamentally it's a very similar process to what the Linux – we were trying to emulate the advantages that the Linux kernel developers had and make it more accessible, right? And more straightforward, right? But really kind of do the exact same thing. But what we never really looked at was the client itself, like branching, right? Like this is one of the things that in the Git Butler Alpha that we're working on is a thing called virtual branches where you can be on more than one branch at the same time, right? Have a really smart index where every change is sort of earmarked for a specific branch and you can be on three branches simultaneously and commit them separately and update them separately, right? But keep them all merged in your working directory. And it's not even that dissimilar from what people that are really good at Git can do, right? Like kernel maintainers or you know, Git maintainer will pull in several trees and merge them temporarily to see if they all work together, right? And then undo the merge and then pull in sort of one at a time. But there's no particular reason that you can't do that without creating that merge. That you can create the merge itself without creating the merge artifact, right? And sort of populating the history with these merge artifacts. You can do tree manipulation that's more in memory that I think is more, it's allows you to not have to think about it as much, which is really what you want to do, right? Like, I want to look at your branch while I'm working on my two branches and have them all on my tree at the same time and evaluate them simultaneously. Or I want to work on a feature and then see a bug and then fix the bug, but not have to commit it into the history or switch branches and commit it and push it and get it merged upstream and cherry pick it down or whatever. Like, however people get around only being able to be on one branch at one time. Like, there's just not a lot of imagination that's happened around how can we create these trees, right? How can we look at and review changes independently and kind of either have them dependent if they're dependent or independent if they're really independent, right? And be able to work with those structures easily. And the things that Git was not originally intended to do are still not easy. And we've just kind of worked around that.
So the good old integration branch, can I have staging for an hour and integrate my changes with yours? So that is what what you're going to solve.
Yeah, I mean, right now, the way that we've implemented is you kind of have your local working directory as your integration branch, right? Like, you can pull in everything that will merge cleanly or test out merges or whatever and have them all locally and see if they work. And then it doesn't really matter what order they actually get merged into upstream, because at the end of the day, if all of those branches get merged in, then that's what the tree looks like. But you kind of can work backwards from that, right? Like, you can create the tree and then separate out the branches into different branches and review them separately and then merge them in any order. But in the end of the day, the end result of those three branches being merged is going to be the same tree. So, you know, it doesn't really, like, it's all about the trees. and it's just that people don't think about it that way. They think about the diffs, right? And that's not really, A, how Git works, but, like, it's how it makes it understandable. And so how can we work backwards from that and say, how do you really want to work? Do you want to be switching branches all the time? Or do you want to just do a bunch of work and then separate it as late as possible and commit it as late as possible when you think it's ready, right?
One thing that wouldn't be solved with that if you do it locally is one key feature that is also missing for so many people, that's previews, right? Like, having previews, like, for especially for web developers, having previews of a pull request is something that Heroku actually, like, invented back then. I think before they sold, or when they sold to Salesforce, and then, like, nothing happened since then. Like, there are a few companies that try to solve that. Obviously, like, the modern like Versal, for example, solves it, I think, like, and others as well. But like, having a real solution for that would be great. Do you have ideas on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a little bit different. I feel like preview that, like, well, A, that's very specific to a type of technology, right? So you can have previews for web. If you're working in Rails or PHP, or you're working in, you know, like, Node or whatever, like, you can have a branch that's sort of deployed into a specific URL that you can test out independently. But if you're working in, like, we're building this in Tori, it'd be a little bit difficult to have sort of a build of a desktop app from a particular branch that you can preview independently. And so it depends on, like, a lot of it is of that type of thing is more, once we have a branch, how do we look at it independently, right? And I think for the most part, it's useful to just look at the diff and be able to do it, or to be able to, like I was saying, to be able to pull it down. So if you have a branch and you've separated out a bug fix from the feature that you're working on, I want to be able to pull down the branch that's just your bug fix and verify it locally, right? And be able to run it in my desktop app build and say, yep, this is, you know, or run it through CI separately or something like that. And that, it depends on, is it a preview branch? Is it, you know, a GitHub action that kind of can CI that independently? Is it something I can pull down and verify, or, you know, a QA person can pull down and verify? Like, it really depends on the technology. But, like, I think it's still valuable to be able to say, there is a constraint in Git that you can only be on one branch at one time. Like, the index and the head are specifically designed for that, and you can't get around that, right? And so if you rethink that, is it necessary to only have to be on one branch at a time? Then it opens up other workflows that I think can be really compelling.
And looking at, or coming back to your company and your idea, like, is it purely desktop, or is there some sort of a server-side component, team features, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, what we're trying to, I mean, a lot of it's alpha, right? Like a lot of it is us kind of being like, what would be cool? Like, what, how do we want to work, and what would be cool? What we're building right now is we have the client, and we own the client in a way that you know GitHub never had, right? Like, they have GitHub Desktop, but it is a very vanilla sort of Git implementation, right? It doesn't really do anything that Git you can't do with Git itself. We're trying to rethink that and say, okay, it's recording all the time and it's doing virtual branches and it's doing stuff that Git can't do. But in the end of the day, it's writing artifacts that Git understands, and GitHub can still use GitHub PRs and things like that. But we have an opportunity to have something that's in between, and that GitHub, actually, I remember when I was there and we were talking about if we can have more, it kind of became draft pull requests or something, but can you open up a PR? Can you kind of stream work, right? So you can see somebody's sort of working directory before they've committed anything. Is that possible? And it wasn't, because we were really trying to stick to Git specifically, right? So you had to create commits and push them in order to see them on the network. What we're able to do if we own the client, though, is to rethink that, to let you hit a button that synchronizes your work to our server, to like an intermediate server. If you know, let's say you're using GitHub for PR and for CI and for deployment, you can still sort of synchronize, like say you have a team of five people and they all kind of have this sync on, then it can go to our servers and you can see other people's work. And that enables a lot of really interesting things that we can't do in version control today or with GitHub today, which is something in between sort of a... So let me go back a second, because one of the things that's interesting is that we used to have this very centralized version control systems, right? And so everything, if you couldn't commit unless it went to the server. And now you have these decentralized version control systems, but ironically, we still really have a central point of contact, which is GitHub, right? Or GitLab or whatever it is you're using. But you don't really use it in a decentralized manner, right? Like everybody still collaborates at one point, but we're not taking any advantage of having a centralized server. So like, let's imagine that we're using a client that's synchronizing all of our work in progress, like a Google Doc or whatever, to a centralized place. Now we can do really interesting things at that centralized place that aren't happening now. We can check for merge conflicts as soon as you start editing a file, right? If you're editing a file and I'm editing a file, right now, what happens is we can work for 3 days. We open up pull requests. We review pull requests. We still don't know that those two branches conflict, right? Like GitHub will only tell you that a branch conflicts with master. It won't tell you that a branch conflicts with another active branch that somebody else is working on. But it knows where they're going, right? Like it could check and tell you, hey, by the way, you should probably talk to this other person, because one of the two of you is going to merge first, and that person will have 0% of the work of integration. And then the second person will have 100% of the work of integration if there's a merge conflict of some sort, right? But you could tell that from the moment one person starts typing a line that will conflict with another person that's working on an active branch. You should get a notification that says, hey, you probably want to talk to them because you guys are editing the same file and this will end in a conflict, and it's just going to be a race of who hits the merge button first, because that's the person that will have no work, right? What I think would be much more valuable, and something that I think we can do, is synchronize your sort of working directory or your virtual branches in progress or your even commits that you have that you aren't integrated yet, and start doing merges in memory on the server and saying, hey, this is going to be a problem. Start letting you even collaborate on the resolution together, right? So that if you have both these branches merged sort of or applied at the same time, you can work on a merge conflict resolution together, right? That merge conflict resolution can be shared over the network, and you can apply it and you can look at it and say, okay, yes, when these two are together, here's how you can even comment on it and agree on this is what the resolution should be when they're together, but apart, maybe it's a little bit different, right? So if one doesn't get merged, that's fine. But if one does get merged, then whoever merges first, it doesn't matter, because you already know about the conflict, you've already worked on the resolution together, it's already agreed upon, and then it's just whatever the second one, it's automatically applied. It's like, okay, well, the second one, when it gets merged in, here's you know, the conflict resolution that's already been agreed upon. Like, that type of workflow has never been able to exist, and I think everybody struggles from that. Like, merge conflicts are a huge problem, and having a centralized, like, let's just embrace the fact that we have a centralized server and that's how we're working, and have a lot of the advantages of decentralized systems, but take advantage of some of the things we can do with a centralized system, right? And I think that there's tons of really interesting things that we can do when we communicate and share data much earlier.
Yeah, it's funny that you like Git exists in that decentral way, and still people ended up centralizing like everything, right? Like just having that funnel, everything has to go through, and it can be very frustrating, as you know, right? Like whenever you commit late, you submit late, and then you have all those conflicts. So it sounds like your vision is more like having some sort of a Google Doc where like a way of collaborating in the future.
Well, I think my vision, I think my vision is more, we use the phrase at GitButler internally a lot, shifting left, like it's sort of this testing phrase, but like trying to move earlier a lot of the processes that can be moved earlier. So like review, like can we review before we commit, right? Like this is something that you can do on sort of like the Linux kernel, like the mailing list. Like let's look at the way that Git was designed, right, in the mailing list. You can roll a patch series and send it to the mailing list and get feedback on everything and then re-roll the series, right? And so you can incorporate that feedback and re-roll another series. Like if you look at the Git mailing list, for example, there's like patch series, you know, V4, V5, V8, right? Like they just keep re-rolling the same five commits over and over, incorporating feedback. And then they end with this very nice, you know, at the end when it is merged in, when you know, Junio takes it or whatever, like you have this nice, perfect series that has all the feedback incorporated. It's not eight other commits on the bottom that's like, you know, addressing changes that Scott said on the mailing list. But we have no way of doing that, right? Because we can't really, it's very hard, like I said, to review something that's not committed, right? Because the commit is a prerequisite to sharing the data over the network. And so what I really want to do, which is not true for the Git mailing list, right? Like you share the data over the network as this extracted patch series and not generally put like a push to a server somewhere. So that everybody shares. So I think what is valuable is being able to shift left, like being able to review before you commit, being able to write commit messages before you commit. Actually, it'd be really nice to be able to just like start writing my commit message or my PR sort of description or whatever before I've done anything, like just keep it going. Like if I'm working on a series for 3 days, I'd like to be moving my work in progress to various commits and pre-writing the commit message for it and be able to, rather than at the very, very end of the process saying, okay, now I want to make this three commits, right? And I need to remember what I did over the last 3 days and I need to make this nice series or whatever. Like I think that's kind of, it's unnecessary really, right? Like we can pre-mark all of this stuff and say, this is what the commit will be, right? And even share that and have people be able to review that and like make changes before it's difficult to do, and then just kind of put it in concrete at the end, at the last possible second. So I think being able to, you know, own the client and rethink some of these processes and share data with your team much earlier gives us the opportunity to build tools that we've never had that I think we would all really enjoy and just don't know that we're missing because we never have had anything. I mean, there's probably a lot of people listening to this podcast that have never used a version control that's not Git, right? Like they don't know really even like the advantages or disadvantages of it compared to other systems because it's so ubiquitous now. I think, you know, largely thanks to GitHub, which was kind of the first thing that came in and combined these systems of how you'd work in a private company and how you'd work in open source, right? Like now the workflows and the tooling is really the same for lots and lots of people. And it's been around for so long now that there's just lots of professionals that have never used anything else. But like there are other ways that we can work. And I think, you know, being able to review before you commit, being able to see what people like, you know, get alerts when you're conflicting with somebody much earlier in the process rather than at merge to upstream, right? Like I think we can come up with some really, really interesting ways of improving our workflows.
Yeah, sounds great. Really looking forward to it. Question is still like, will it be a 100 million market or a 10 billion market again? what are your thoughts on that?
I think I said at the beginning that nobody knows what they're talking about. So whatever I answer, I don't know what I'm talking about. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's still, you know, the software industry expands all the time, and I think technology continues to expand. There's always going to be any way that you can improve software developers' lives is a huge market, right? It doesn't really matter. Like people don't even pay that much for GitHub if you really think about it. Like, if you think about it compared, like, you know, I run a company, like, my GitHub bill is almost nothing, and it's one of the most valuable tools that I have. And that's been even a complaint that we had when we were at GitHub, that people were like, you need to be charging more for this. People aren't taking you seriously, right? And when you're in larger companies, and I think it remains true. It is the best value that I have in my software development stack. And so even if everybody, I want to live in a world where everybody still uses GitHub and they use us, you know, on the front end of that, right, to improve all of the processes before, you know, getting to all of the cool stuff that GitHub does, the sort of final PR review or the GitHub actions, the CI, the deployment, like everything that I think GitHub does, a lot of issues, like everything, right? I don't want to get into any of that. But I do want to make the client better. I want to make archaeology better. I want to make it easier to answer questions about the history of your code, like not just Git blame, right, which is limitedly useful. I want to say, who's in charge of this function? Who's in charge of this file? How did this come to be? Like, why was it written this way? Like, I think that there's a lot of AI tools. There's a lot of, you know, if we have better history on how exactly something came together, that you can ask useful questions and get useful answers out that essentially nobody asks right now because it's too difficult, right? Like running, who even knows how to run Git blame effectively, right? Like it's actually, I've been giving a talk where I'm showing people options to Git blame. The thing about command line tools is that 1% of people learn how to do 1% of the command line flags, right? So most people just run Git blame and that's it. And it's actually not very useful that way. Like, you want to run Git blame and you really want to get an answer, you need to run, you know, Git blame -W --C --C, because then that actually goes and tries to figure out who was originally responsible for one line. But that's still only answering the question, who last touched this line of code, in a slightly better way, right? But that's not really the question you want to ask. The question you want to ask when you're running archaeology tools like Git blame is, what was happening here? Explain to me, right? What you really want is the person who wrote it or the people that collaborated on it in a little conference call and be like, can somebody explain this to me, right? But like, nobody has time for that and it's too difficult or somebody left or whatever. But like, I feel like we're at the cusp of having tooling that can do this in a way that's much better than Git blame, that's much better than Git log for answering a lot of questions about what we want. So there's, you know, I'm talking about how to work in branches, how to review stuff, but also how to answer questions about your code or how to learn about your code or learn about the context of how it was written or why it was written. Like, there's just tons and tons of stuff that's completely untouched. So I think there's a huge market for it if you do it right.
Why to use Rebase, right?
I mean, yeah. My favorite thing to do is get a, should you rebase or should you merge? And now there's, yeah. Or should you squash merge, right? And everybody has just religious argumentation around it. And in the end of the day, I think it doesn't matter, right? Like, a lot of these are artifacts of a tool set that aren't built for really what we want to be able to do. And I'd like to do is build a tool where nobody cares, right? It just doesn't matter. Like, none of this stuff is super important. It just matters, does the code work? What is the history of it? How do I get context about how to write better code or to not forget lessons of the past, right? Those are the things you want to answer with these questions, right? And like people want to rebase because they want to run Git bisect. And I've met like three people in my life who have ever successfully run Git bisect. Like, nobody cares. Like, it's just, or they want there are more important ways of answer of tackling these questions than saying everybody should rebase or everybody should squash merge or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, reminds me of the good old two tabs versus spaces, right? or two spaces versus tabs, that way around.
I mean, I think we all know it's spaces, but that's fine.
It's absolutely spaces, yeah. So you must be like, if you care about collaboration that much, you must be into productivity hacks as well. Like, what is your most recent best productivity hack in the last months, let's say?
You know what?
No virtual branches, please.
I don't have anything particularly good. I mean, I would say exercise is actually my best productivity hack, except that I don't exercise nearly as much as it would come from that answer. But like, if I work all day and my brain is hurting and then I go, you know, take a run or something and then come back, I can do more longer. But like, I think it's different for everybody. I you know what I struggle with though that I find really interesting is sort of this second brain thing. Like I have ideas and things that I want to remember in the middle of the night or in the shower or when we're walking to work or something like that. And I've tried everything on the planet and they all let me down in some way or another. Like I think I've tried everything, Obsidian, and I use Bear right now a lot, but like it needs to sync to all my devices. I need to be able to, you know, just sort of say it into my phone and remember it later or remember it at the right time or something. And it's I'm answering the opposite of this question, which is what is a productivity hack I want to have? And I don't actually, you know what? Never mind. I do want to come back to this. I do have something that I use that I love that I do want everybody. I'm an unofficial spokesman for Rewind. If you haven't used Rewind.ai, it's my favorite tool that I've found recently, and it actually inspired some of the ideas that we've come up with at Kitbutler stuff, because it records my screen all the time, which means I never forget. Like I constantly forget what's the command line option that I remember that I ran this, you know, PNPM Tori dev or what. I used it for the other day of trying to remember how to what the flag was for some test options in Cargo or something in Rust, right? And it's like, I can't remember, but I can remember parts of it. And so I'll search through my history and just put it down to Kitty, which is my terminal emulator, and just say, just show me stuff that has this focused, that has this, you know, the Cargo line or whatever. And then I can remember roughly when it is and go back and find it, or documentation that I found at some point or some like random AWS, you know, blog that told me how to open up a port for my, you know, Postgres database or something like that. Like I just having my screen recorded all the time so that I never actually, the other thing is really valuable is screenshot. Like if I want a screenshot of our app and I knew I had it in a state that, you know, it was in that state, instead of trying to go back and manipulate the data and get my system back into that state, I can just go through sort of the history of my screen and find that and screenshot it and then use that. And so like that is the best. If you're not using Rewind.ai, 100% use Rewind.ai. It's really amazing.
Okay, that's great. It's like kind of next step would be having like a personal LLM that like learns everything you learn, but just doesn't forget, right?
Yeah, I actually, that's really what I want. I want something I can like clip on my shirt and it just records everything that happens and I can just say something, right? And then it reminds me later. And if it weren't for privacy concerns of those around me, I would do that immediately.
So coming to my outro question, I still have a little surprise for you. Your partner in crime at GitHub, Chris, actually told me about like an Easter egg. He actually hacked into GitHub history, like the history feature in the web, which allows you to travel back in time, like really for sure. You just have to add like a get parameter with a date and a person. And then it brings you back to that moment in life of that person. And we now add you there as a person, and then as a date, we take July 2004, when you actually started working at Reactrix System as an engineer, I think. And we now travel back in time and watch yourself there, like coding. You just like still doing PHP, no Ruby, like really like shitty old stuff, hacking around. And you now have the chance to whisper something into young Scott's ears. What would it be?
Boy, you know, I think about this a lot. And I feel like this is the most boring answer in the world, but I wouldn't tell him anything because my life has been fantastic. And like even the crappy times, like it's so hard to like I don't really regret anything. Like there's been hard times, there's been sad stuff, there's been depression, there's been, you know, the horrible things that have happened. But like at the end of the day, like it's all an interesting adventure, and I love where I am now, and I'm fascinated by what's going to be in the future. But like it's really, really difficult to want to redo things, right? Like you, everything that sucks you learn from, and everything that's great you enjoy. And so I would, yeah, I don't know, I'd just say do what you I mean, actually, I guess, you know, if I would, I'd give this to anybody, but it's do what you enjoy doing, right? Like say yes to things, get out of your comfort zone. Like I still try to do that and it's still uncomfortable and it's always still rewarding. And I think I was relatively good about that young, but like maybe double down on that, right? Like do what's uncomfortable and optimize for what you really love doing every day. Like it's a great thing. You said this before, right? Like why am I'm back to version control systems and stuff. Like GitHub exit was huge. Like I really don't need to work. But I can't see myself not working. Like it's just, it's fun to do stuff, to build things, to imagine a slightly different world and try to make it happen and then see how you can, you know, how you can iterate from that. So yeah, that's a long-winded answer that is not very specific, but
a good answer. But, very good answer.
Yeah.
It seems as if you're happy. So yeah, thanks a lot. I'm happy now as well. it was a great recording with you. Thanks a lot for that, and hope to see you soon in Berlin or wherever.
Actually, I do want to put in one thing. It was funny because we met each other at this conference, at the meetup at the end when we're kind of having beers together, and otherwise this wouldn't happen. And I met the Ruby guys for GitHub at a meetup, right? So if I do have one sort of final piece of advice for anybody listening, especially young people, like go to meetups and meet people and make connections and, you know, that like kind of get out of your comfort zone, but like go have beers with people because it's opened every door that I've ever had open for me, I think, is because I met some random person, you know, having beers at a bar somewhere and it always leads to something interesting in your life. So, get out absolutely. And have beers.
Absolutely. Can just second that. So thanks a lot, Scott. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the AlphaList podcast. If you like this episode, share it with friends. I'm sure they love it too. Make sure to subscribe so you can hear deep insights into technical leadership and technology trends as they become available. Also, please tell us if there is a topic you would like to hear more about or a technical leader whose brain you would like us to pick. AlphaList is all about helping CTOs getting access to the insights they need to make the best decisions for their company. Please send us suggestions to cto@alphaList.com. Send me a message on LinkedIn or Twitter. After all, the more knowledge we bring to CTOs, the more growth we see in tech. Or, as we say on AlphaList, accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth. See you in the next episode.